Should I start talking yet? Is this a good time? All right. Well, hello there. This is Stephen Cohen from the beautiful city of Colorado Springs, here for episode 5 of the podcast, Quantitative Investigations. I'm here with Goose the Engineer.
Yo.
And what do we have for lunch or dinner today there, Goose the Engineer?
Well, the fast food streak ran out because I'm broke. So I have honey roasted pistachios, a great source of plant protein. Shout out to Wonderful Pistachios. The brand is wonderful. I'm not just saying they're wonderful.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderfulpistachios.com. And it's got a little, like, the O is a heart. Isn't that great?
It seems to me we've spent around one more minute more than we really needed to on this particular topic.
Just about a minute 17.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm feeling a little punchy today. Today was a Yom Kippur for those who celebrate and observe. I'm still feeling the low blood sugar effects from not eating all day. And I am happy to report that God has not stricken me dead today. So let's knock on fake wood, eh? I've repented for my sins, and now I can be a jerk for the rest of the year.
That's how it's done.
Alrighty then. Well, today we're going to be discussing the 2020 election. Was it stolen? Was it not stolen? That's the question we're going to, that's the question we're going to look at today. I do have a follow-up on my inflation podcast episode. I've seen some really interesting news articles. I suggest taking a look at John Carney from Breitbart Business. He actually pointed out some things that it really didn't dawn on me. You know, number one, that inflation is migratory. It goes from sector to sector. For example, if one is to assume that the lower supply, higher demand for energy or petroleum increased gas prices and then that rippled down, it has actually moved to food. And food prices are actually becoming a very good barometer for inflation. And food prices are up significantly. Even though gas prices are down, food prices are up. And that, of course, affects everyone significantly. The other thing that kind of dawned on me is that there are two ways to fight inflation. And it didn't really dawn on me because of any great thoughts of mine. It's because of stuff that I heard. And that seemed to make sense. The Federal Reserve fights inflation from the demand side. So interest rates increase, which means borrowing money becomes more expensive, and that cuts down on demand for goods. However, the federal government can actually also fight inflation from the supply side. Lowering taxes, decreasing regulations, making it easier for products to get to market. They can do that. Supposedly that's what Reagan did. I'm not really an expert on Reaganomics, even though that was the first, his 84 election was the first election in which I voted, and I did vote for him, but I'm not really an expert on Reaganomics, but supposedly that's what he did. However, it is true that the federal government on the supply side can lower inflation. And this notion that we need to cause a recession to reduce inflation is not necessarily the case. But that is the only tool that the Federal Reserve has. So really, when it comes to effective inflation fighting, you need the Federal Reserve and you need the federal government to be working hand in hand to come up with a cohesive strategy to fight inflation. Or else, if you only leave it up to the Federal Reserve, well, guess what? It's going to be a painful fight to reduce inflation. So, just thought I'd bring that up as a follow-up to one of my previous episodes. Okay, what do you say, Goose, we get to the heart of the matter?
I absolutely can't wait. Let's just dive right in, you know? I'm on the edge of my seat.
I hope everyone in the audience could just hear the sarcasm in his voice. Because to me, it's just, I can feel it. Even though we're separated by a soundproof wall, I can feel the sarcasm.
I have some vocal effects that might be able to bring it out more, too.
Let's hear it.
I can't just, it's not an on-command situation.
Oh, okay. That's just pull the rug out from under me.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Straight from under you. If only there was actually a rug under you to begin with. But, you know.
Okay. I think I've wasted enough time. Let's go. Oops, I said I'm not supposed to do that. Let's go to the 2020 election. Okay. Was it stolen? I'm gonna give you the punchline up front. Maybe. And that's probably the best you're gonna get out of this podcast. Because when you're looking at elections, and I'll tell you right now, this was not an easy episode to research. This is not an easy topic to understand. And anyone who says it is easy, they're not being honest with you. Because there's a lot to look into. But what I hope that everyone gets out of this is when we have elections and people are, you know, fighting over whether or not it was stolen, yada, 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 I hope people just remember what the information that you actually need to figure out for yourselves whether or not an election was stolen. Now you have to remember something. There's a difference between election fraud and stealing an election. There is a difference. Election fraud, as I am using it here, is election practices that violate the Constitution, violate federal election laws, violate state election laws. And for the most part, it's going to be state election laws because the Constitution enables the states to set the election laws. I'll get to that in a minute. Stealing an election is committing enough fraud to actually sway the results of an election. Now, I've heard for years that the Democrats and John F. Kennedy stole the 1960 election. I've heard this for years, never looked into it. So for this podcast, I thought I would see if I can find something on it. And there's a news spot on newsbusters.org where Andrea Mitchell admits that the 1960 election was obviously stolen. Well, okay. Then you start seeing other articles where they say maybe there was fraud, but it was not stolen. I walked away from doing a minimal amount of research because, quite frankly, I lost interest. But it's still not clear to me whether or not the election was stolen. Was there election fraud? Was there ballot box stuffing? Probably. But was it enough to steal an election? And mind you, there's been election fraud in just about every election that I've been engaged in. For example, in 2008, Acorn, which was a nonprofit organization, a community activist organization, was doing some funky ballot stuffing and ballot harvesting. I think they were actually convicted. Some people were convicted from the Acorn scandal. And you know what that means, Goose?
What does that mean?
That means the conjecture alert. Conjecture alert. I believe that some people were convicted from Acorn. in some election fraud. But there's been election fraud going on probably in every election, whether or not there were voting machines. So this is not an easy topic to discuss. So what do we need to do here? Well, when you're looking at whether or not a fraud has occurred, the first thing you need to look at is at the U.S. Constitution. Then you need to look at state election laws. Now, if some voting practice violates either the Constitution, and not just voting practice, if some legal decision violates the Constitution or state election laws, or if a voting or counting practice violates state law, a fraud has occurred. Okay? A fraud has occurred. Now, let's go to the United States Constitution. The United States, Section 4 of Article 1 is called Elections. It states, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives, notice it doesn't say president, shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as to the places of choosing senators. Okay, what does that mean? That means the state legislatures take first crack at choosing the times, places, and manner of holding elections. The federal government can make elections. They can do that. But it's generally up to the states. So, was this constitutional mandate followed? Well, in actuality, they actually keep revisiting this issue. And the Supreme Court, I'll discuss this a little later, the Supreme Court in this session is going to be hearing a case about states' rights when it comes to elections. So we'll see what happens. I looked at two states. And that's all I really had time to do because this really got complicated really quickly. So I looked at two states, Pennsylvania and Georgia, where election laws were changed. But I didn't really understand. And let me tell you, a lot of news pundits and commentators are saying, yeah, election laws were changed, yada, yada. Well, it's true, but it wasn't really clear how constitutional these changes were. So Pennsylvania legislature passed Act 77, and Tom Wolf signed this act into law in October of 2019. And it was to make voting more convenient and more secure. Okay? That's the way it's supposed to happen. The legislator created a law, and it was signed into law by the governor. Perfectly constitutional. Governor Tom Wolf then, on June 1st, 2020, issued an executive order, and that executive order was 2020-02, and it changed the deadline for primary, absentee voting. For primary absentee voting. The issue is, can the governor do that? I think a governor can, even though it's not the state legislature, because a primary is not an election for senators and representatives. It's an election for candidates. It seems to me that is constitutional. Now, where it gets murky is that there was a lawsuit. And in this lawsuit, voting deadlines for the general election were changed. And it was a lawsuit filed by the Pennsylvania Democrat Party. And it was at court action number 133-MM-2020. And it was against the Secretary of the Commonwealth. So this lawsuit went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided was that, number one, the election code permits the county boards. Now, there were more than, it was more than just one decision. There were a few decisions in this. But the decisions read as follows. The election code permits county boards of elections to collect hand-delivered mail-in ballots at locations other than their offices, including drop boxes. Okay. I the problem with that is, if that's what the code says, then that's allowed. Here's where it starts getting murky. A three-day extension of the absentee and mail-in ballot received by deadline is adopted such that ballots mailed by voters via the United States Postal Service and postmarked 8 p.m. on Election Day, November 3rd, 2020, shall be counted if they are otherwise valid and received by the county boards of election on or before 5 p.m. on November 6, 2020. If that's not in the election law, then that is an unconstitutional ruling. It's an unconstitutional ruling. Because if that's, because that would be called legislating from the bench. Here's another one. And this was written by the judge in this decision. Ballots received within this period that lack a postmark or other proof of mailing, or for which the postmark or other proof of mailing is illegible, will be presumed to have been mailed by Election Day unless a preponderance of the evidence demonstrates that it was mailed after Election Day. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a beautiful example of legislating from the bench. Judges cannot write law. They cannot. That violates separation of powers in the United States Constitution. This provision regarding the illegibility or lack of a postmark is not in the law. I looked for it. I could not find it. It's not in there. There, and this was actually a suggestion put in writing by the Secretary of the Commonwealth. This is an unconstitutional act. Right here. Unconstitutional act. This. So anyway. That's a major problem. When you start getting judges legislating from the bench, that is a major problem. By the way, one of the most famous acts of legislation from the bench is Chief Justice John Roberts' decision regarding Obamacare. The Obama administration testified to the Supreme Court that the money that was to be paid by people who were not insured was a fee. They specifically stated it was a fee. Chief Justice John Roberts changed that to a tax. He did that because if you go read the decision, I suggest everyone read this decision because this is a pure example of how judges can monkey around with the law. Chief Justice John Roberts actually determined that the U.S. federal government cannot force anybody into commerce. He determined it. But then he also stated, under Congress's Article I taxing authority, they are allowed to impose a tax for certain things, including health and welfare. It's in Article I, that it's in the taxing authority under Article I, where Congress can pass laws using the taxing authority for the health and welfare of the public. And he said, and then he made this thing up where if a law violates one part of the Constitution, but then it complies with another part of the Constitution, then precedent shows that it should be constitutional. Complete and utter garbage. Complete and utter garbage. Now, if the Obama administration had actually stated that this was a tax and not a fee, I'm not necessarily sure how unconstitutional that decision was, but Chief Justice John Roberts legislated from the bench. That is unconstitutional. Can't do it. Now, this case went to the Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania Republicans sued. It did go to the Supreme Court in front of Justice Samuel Alito. He upheld that ballots must be received, that any ballots received by mail after 8 p.m. on November 3rd can be segregated, kept in a secure, safe, sealed container separate from other voted ballots, and that all such ballots, if counted, should be counted separately. I don't know what that does, but he also stated, and I'm trying to find it here, he says, I am immediately referring this application to the conference and direct that any response be filed as soon as possible, but in any event, no later than 2 p.m. I haven't seen that response. But it appears that part of the lawsuit was upheld, in other words, allowing ballots to be counted that were going to be received by mail after 8 p.m. on November 3rd. This is part of the problem that the Supreme Court's going to be looking into. But this is how judges and advocacy groups can actually get election law changed. And I'm not going to say it's unconstitutional yet. That has not been determined. But when you start messing around with the proof of mailing, whether it's a lack of postcard, you just assume that it's all been mailed, that's a problem. That's an easy way to commit fraud. Whether or not that leniency was actually upheld and whether or not ballots were counted that didn't have any postmark, I don't know. I'm sure there are news articles that may refer to that. I don't know. So I hope you're getting a flavor for just how complicated this can get. And I've only been able to dive into two states. Getting to Georgia. Georgia is another fairly interesting case. The Secretary of State sent out 6.9 million applications. And this is, I'm reading from www.election.conservative.org. And it describes the case. Secretary of State sent out over 6.9 million applications for absentee ballots. The New Georgia Project, which was a group formed by a former gubernatorial candidate, Stacey Abrams. Actually, she is a current gubernatorial candidate as well in this election. They complained that there were insufficient standards for notifying voters about incomplete applications. They wanted a 65-year-old age minimum for people to submit one application for year-long absentee voting. Failure to prepare prepaid postage, a deadline for receipt of absentee ballots at 7 p.m. on election day, prohibition on third-party assistance for absentee ballots. Yeah, so that's what they were complaining about. They didn't want that prohibition on ballot harvesting. They were complaining about the deadline. So what happened was the district court, and this is Judge Eleanor Ross, she denied all the requests, but she did change the 3-day, and she did change the deadline. She granted a 3-day extension to receive ballots that were postmarked by November 3rd. This actually, and the Secretary of State, actually, who is a defendant in this previous case that went to the district court judge, appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. And by the way, I downloaded the U.S. Court of Appeals decision took a look at it. It's pretty interesting. And I'm going to read to you from that decision. Let me see if there's any identification. If I actually have that loaded up. Do I have it? 11th Court of Appeals. 11th Circuit Court. Yeah, okay. And this is case 20-13360. And it was filed on October 2nd, 2020. So it's a three-judge panel. The panel actually states this. The United States Constitution still gives states the power to set the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives. Notice how it doesn't say president. By the way, this is the second time I said that. The reason why, if you look in the text of the Constitution, the reason why it doesn't say president, because when the Constitution was first ratified, citizens did not directly vote for the president. It was merely, it was an electoral college. But there was no vote for president. That was changed by an amendment, and I apologize, I don't remember which amendment it was. Although there is a direct election. There's a direct election for president, though the Electoral College still actually ends up selecting the president. That's why we have all the electoral votes. You awake there, Goose?
This conversation is like coffee to me. Just the more we go, the more energized I get.
Feeling the sarcasm, my friend. Feeling the sarcasm. Yeah, that's why I have Goose here. I got to break up the conversation because I can go on and on, and I can just feel people falling asleep. But that is the way it goes.
I think you just feel yourself falling asleep.
I got to tell you, I'm kind of drained today. Yeah, I'm a little drained today.
It's could have to do with having no food for 24 hours, but...
Yeah, I didn't make it to full 24 this year or any year. I usually make it to around 18 or 20 hours.
Fair enough.
Usually 20 hours.
Fair enough.
So what it says, U.S. Circuit Court decision, it's the 11th Circuit Court. The United States Constitution still gives the states the power to set the times, places, manner of holding elections for senators and representatives. And that power is matched by state control over the election process for state offices. To be sure, no right is more precious in a free country than that of having a voice in the election of those who make the laws under which, as good citizens, we must live. But we also know that the right to vote is the right to participate in an electoral process that is necessarily structured to maintain the integrity of the democratic system. Now, that might sound like a bit of judicial bloviating, but this next paragraph politely admonishes the district court judge, and again, her name is Eleanor Ross. So this is a polite admonishment of Judge Eleanor Ross. Instead, the district court manufactured its own ballot deadline so that the state is now required to count any ballot that was both postmarked by and received within 3 days of Election Day. And though our dissenting colleague suggests that we should defer to the district court's judgment on this issue, the law does not allow us to step back. If the trial court misapplies the law, we will review and correct the error without deference to that court's determination. What are these guys saying? So, and just so I can clarify for everyone, there was a three-judge panel, one judge dissented. The majority is saying judges can't change election law. They can't do it. And why can't they do it? Because of Article 1, Section 4. So this is actually, first of all, I guess it's mind-blowing to me that a court would actually come out with such a clearly worded decision. But this is kind of mind-blowing. The state legislatures are duly authorized to set the times, places, and manner of choosing senators and representatives. So, where does that leave the courts? Goose, where does that leave the courts?
Somewhere.
That is correct, but we don't know where because that hasn't been decided yet by the Supreme Court.
Lame.
Now, the other question that we need to get to in some of this was election law violated? Now, when you look at Georgia, I don't know. I think that's actually being investigated. But what's happening right now, and I'm going to discuss this court case first. The court case that the Supreme Court is going to look at is Moore versus Harper. And I've got this from Ballotpedia. Ballotpedia used to be just a website that discussed or presented candidates for just about every race in the country. It's really an encyclopedia of political races. But they do a lot more than that. They have a lot of information on Ballotpedia. And regarding this case, according to Ballotpedia, the issue is this case concerns the independent state legislature doctrine, the ISL. The ISL is Section 4, Article 1 of the United States Constitution, which theorizes that state legislatures alone are empowered by the Constitution to regulate federal elections without oversight from state courts. Click here to learn more. Oh, I wasn't supposed to read that. So this is actually mind-blowing, ladies and gentlemen. Quite frankly, I don't understand why this hasn't been settled. Why this hasn't been settled in the 200-plus years of the United States Constitution, but this is pretty mind-blowing stuff that this is going to get settled, and I don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't know what the real answer is. I suppose if a state imposes election laws that do discriminate against certain groups, I suppose that then they should be up for state and federal review. But this is really interesting stuff. And so, again, this will be decided. Getting back to Georgia, and this is going to ballot harvesting. When you hear claims of fraud, there's certain pieces of information that you need. Again, you need to know what the Constitution says. You need to know what the state law says. You need to know what the voting practice is that is of concern and whether or not it happened. And if you're reading a news story and you're not getting all those pieces of information, then you are not getting the full story. Now, according to this news article, and I'm trying to find the particular news article. Pardon my. Here it is. Okay, this is from Just the News. So it's justthenews.com. It's a story that supposedly Georgia is opening up an investigation into illegal ballot harvesting. So this is the practice where people will go around. A lot of times they'll go around to senior citizen communities, senior citizen homes, assisted living homes, and they'll just grab ballots, take the ballots from the voters, and en masse deliver them. Georgia strictly prohibits that. And it actually could be a very nasty tactic. To actually commit fraud. And also, and the U.S. Supreme Court over the summer actually rejected a Democrat effort to overturn an Arizona law that also outlawed harvesting. So harvesting is actually something that's becoming outlawed. When you look at all the fraud, and this is the big question. When you look at all the fraud that could have happened, was it enough to turn the election? Was it enough? And what does that mean when I say that? What that means is, was the fraud enough to overcome? Let me put it another way. Let me put this another way. And we'll be specific. In 2020, did Donald Trump's apparent unpopularity, if would that have been, if it wasn't for that unpopularity, would that have been enough to overcome the fraud? And I'm saying that because I know plenty of people who voted for Trump in 2016 who did not in 2020 for various what I consider to be superficial reasons. They didn't like the way he spoke and like the color of his hair, you know, that kind of stuff. Never mind about his record, but they did not think he was a presidential guy. However, I will say it, the way the COVID response was handled was, as far as the communications, strictly the communications, was subpar. And that hurt. Because I am an expert at crisis communications. I've gone through a lot of training in crisis communication. I know how to do it. The Trump administration did not know how to do it. So did the fraud actually affect the outcome, or was President Trump's unpopularity, did that really drive his loss? That's a big question. I don't know the answer. I don't think anyone knows the answer. When there are so many people who disaffected away from him in 2020, I don't know if there was no fraud. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that he would have won. I'm not convinced he would have won. So those are the things you need to look at. Again, there's always going to be fraud in an election. People cheat. They do it. It's horrible. I don't know. Again, the interesting thing would be if the 1960 election truly was stolen, that would be an interesting discussion. But I see accounts on both ways, going both ways, so I'm reserving judgment. Now, here's the kicker. There is something that did happen that we have some fairly objective evidence did sway the election. And it wasn't voter fraud. It was tampering by the United States government. What do I mean? This is the whole Hunter laptop story, and I can hear people groaning, going, oh no, he's not going to bring that up again. That was your cue, Goose.
Oh, not the Hunter Biden laptop thing again. Ah.
Nice. Yes. So, okay. The Hunter Biden laptop story broke around September 2020. However, the government got involved. And this is not up for conjecture, or else I would have sounded the conjecture alarm. This is actual fact. The federal government attempted to kill the story so it didn't affect Joe Biden. And it started on October 19th, 2020. A public statement on the Hunter Biden emails was issued and was signed by 50 former, however, I did see two people who I think were actual employees because they don't have the word former in front of their titles. And you can read it. I downloaded it. I'm looking at it right now. And one paragraph that's italicized says, "Perhaps most important, each of us believes deeply that American citizens should determine the outcome of elections, not foreign governments. All of us agree with the Founding Fathers' concern about the damage that foreign interference in our politics can do to our democracy." Then it goes on. "It is for all these reasons that we write to say that the arrival on the U.S. political scene of emails purportedly belonging to Vice President Biden's son Hunter, much of it related to his time serving on the board of the Ukrainian gas company Burisma, as well as the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation." Okay? That's what they say. And it is signed by Jim Clapper, Mike Hayden, Leon Panetta, John Brennan, Thomas Finger, Rick Leggett, John McLaughlin, Michael Morrell, Mike Vickers, Doug Wise, Nick Rasmussen, Russ Travers. I can go on and on. The trying to find the two people who are not former. Gotta find these guys. Hold on, give me a second. Scrolling through the long. So here we go. Yana Heistand Mendez, Technical Operations Officer, Central Intelligence Agency, does not have the word former next to it. Gerald A. O'Shea, Senior Operations Officer, CIA, does not have a former next to it. So these people signed this letter. Supposedly, according to this letter, they are not former intelligence community people, they are current at the time of this letter. And they are all lying. How do we know they are all lying? They stated it was Russian disinformation. Well, problem number one, the computer repair store owner who received the laptop from Hunter Biden himself, his name is John Paul Mac Isaac, he saw the email, saw whatever images there were, and reported it to the FBI. And depending on what news outlet you viewed, you either would have known this or would not have known this. Here's problem number two. Mark Zuckerberg stated on Joe Rogan's podcast, you can look it up yourself, the FBI visited his company and told them that some disinformation is being disseminated and that Facebook should watch out for it. What did Facebook do? And what did Twitter do? They buried the story. They buried the story. Now, why do I consider this fraud? Well, it is fraud because at least the current intelligence community professionals who signed that letter who were not former but were current, they committed fraud. Federal crime. Besides election tampering, which could violate the Hatch Act because it clearly was to benefit one political candidate over another, it's also First Amendment violations. The Media Research Center poll, this I talked about this earlier. Now, Media Research Center is a conservative news outlet. They said 17% of the people would have switched their vote if they knew about the Hunter Biden laptop story. I think approximately 150 million people voted in the election. 140, 150 million. I'll say 150 million. So times 0.17. Let's see what I get here. So that's 25 million votes that could have changed if they had known about this story. Now, here's the question. did the voter fraud result in 25 million false votes? I don't think so. This was a huge election tampering scandal. Still is an election tampering scandal. And it was the federal government is in no way supposed to influence elections. So now, of course, it's been the election's over. And what happened after the election was over? So according to the New York Post, on an article dated March 17th, 2022, the New York Times finally admitted that the Hunter Biden laptop is legitimate. They finally admitted. There are other stories out there that finally admit that the Hunter Biden laptop story is real. So we know everybody lied. We know the FBI lied. We know intelligence, former and current, at the time, intelligence community officials lied. We know that there was illegal influence on social media to bury the story. And we know that there were ramifications in the vote totals. Now, do I necessarily believe that 17% or 25.5 million people would have switched their vote if they knew about the story? I don't believe that. But I certainly believe some fraction would have. And I certainly believe that some fraction would have changed the outcome of the election. And that's why, ladies and gentlemen, man, my conjecture alert went dead. Yeah, I got to do the old conjecture alert. Because, again, this podcast is not about believing. This podcast is about the data. But according to the Media Research Center poll, certainly the intelligence community's impact on the election appears to be real and appears to have significantly affected the outcome of this election. So, was the 2020 election stolen? Maybe. If it was stolen, I'm not convinced it was stolen by voter fraud. If it was stolen, the bigger culprit is the United States federal government, the FBI, CIA, the intelligence community. They are the bigger culprits in this, from what I can see. So, wrapping this up, how long did I bloviate today, Goose?
You went 48 minutes.
Yeah, I had to speak extra slowly today because I didn't really think I had enough material.
No, you're good. You definitely made the cut.
So, wrapping this up, ladies and gentlemen, trying to appease the critics who claim I don't summarize things. When you're trying to look at voter fraud, you need to understand the Constitution, you need to understand the state laws, you need to understand the practices that are being questioned and whether or not they actually violated law. Then you need to understand the lawsuits, whether or not judges legislated from the bench. And I would urge everyone just to keep watch on this decision that's coming up. This is going to be, I don't know how much press this is going to get, but to me, this Moore versus Harper decision is going to be, it's going to be earth-shattering, because if they find that the state courts cannot alter the state legislature's laws on voting, that's going to be huge. So anyway, thank you very much for joining me on this episode. This is episode 5, 2020 election. Was it stolen? From the podcast, Quantitative Investigations. Thank you very much. Bid you a fond adieu.